Pearl Church exists to express a sacred story and to extend a common table that animate life by love. A primary expression of our sacred story is the weekly sermon. If our sermons inspire you to ponder the sacred, to consider the mystery and love of God, and to live bountifully, would you consider supporting our work? You can donate easily and securely at our website, pearlchurch.org, or follow the link in the podcast notes. Thank you for partnering with us in expressing this sacred story.
Throughout the season of Lent, we're in a sermon series titled Stories of Disappointment, which is exploring the life of Moses as a way to lament our own experiences of disappointment while being intentional to consider the potential gifts that disappointment affords us all. Our desire is that this series could grow our capacity to hold both sorrow and hope in the midst of the sincere disappointment that we all encounter. So far, we've considered the disappointment of abandonment, the disappointment of feeling inadequate, the disappointment of outcomes for which we have great hope in, and the disappointment of people. This morning, we're going to explore the disappointment of God. The disappointment of God. Why does God allow suffering? Why does God allow pain? Why does God allow bad things to happen? If God is in control, and if God is good, and if God is loving, why is there so much stuff here on earth in our lives that hurts and makes no sense? Why? As Moses put it in our reading from the Hebrew Scriptures, why have you brought this trouble on your servant? Or as Jesus put it in our reading from the New Testament, why have you abandoned me? Or as I have often asked over the years, why did my loving 61-year-old mom die when some of my adopted siblings' abusive biological parents continue to live? Why? This question is as ancient as humankind, isn't it? Moses asked it, Jesus asked it, I ask it, you ask it. Why, God, why? And unfortunately, there is no answer. There just isn't. I mean, don't get me wrong, we would all love an answer. I mean, we so much want an answer that we will try to squeeze answers out of places from which answers don't exist. Like, for example, the book of Job, right? We all go to Job. I mean, he suffered. There must be an answer, but there's no answer to why Job suffers. In fact, it's kind of wild, right? The book concludes with him trembling before a whirlwind, capital W, whirlwind, apologetic for even seeking out an answer for why he suffers. Why? Why does God allow suffering? Why does God allow pain? Why does God allow bad things to happen? Why? I have no idea. That's just an honest answer. Now, if we can move beyond the absence of an answer to our question, why, then we are freed up to consider some other important questions for which we do have some answers. But before making that move, I just want to pause and make space for the absence of an answer for this perennially human question, why? About which, if you're anything like me, you want to ask, why? Why is there no answer to this all-important question? And the irony here is that the lack of an answer to this all-important question is to enter into the world of suffering that we're trying to understand. And we could just go around and around and around again and again and again. And so for the next 20 minutes or so, I'd like to invite you to join me in setting aside our perennial pursuit of a question that we cannot answer, to consider three questions that Christianity does have some thoughts about. Those questions are, what is God? We can talk about that for a little bit. Where is God? We can talk about that for a little bit. And then perhaps most importantly, how is God? Which is a grammatically incorrect sentence, but it's really consequential, I think. What is God? Where is God? How? How is God? Let's begin with the question, what is God? The simple answer is that God is a three-letter word. How's that for deep? It's a word. It's breath articulated by lips and tongue that has created families and tribes and instigated wars and violence, influenced kingdoms and politics, and inspired love, mercy, and incredible acts of service. God. What an interesting word. But what is God? In Hebrew, Yahweh, in Greek, Theos, in English, God. I mean, each of these languages has more than just one name for divinity, as does every language. And that's okay, because these words, like all words, are simply containers for meaning. That's all a word is. And so what is the meaning of this word, God? Well, when humans are unable to point at something physical, like a tree, we can point at a tree and we can say tree, and then we all start pointing at trees and saying tree, and maybe we can start to use words to distinguish some trees from other trees. When we're talking about physical objects, physical things, a word will often suffice because we associate the word we're using with the thing we're touching. Oh, man, but what about things that we can't point at? For example, like justice or equity or the idea of God itself. Well, that's when things start to get tricky. When humans lack a physical object to point at and name, we are left with words and metaphors and stories to try and explain. With this in mind, a Christian story about God that has stood out, a Christian story about God that's recalled again and again and again throughout the scriptures. There's a Christian story that Jesus, the Word of God, connects to his very own identity in John's gospel. It's located in Exodus chapter 3. In this chapter, Moses is in the wilderness when he sees a bush on fire, but the bush isn't being consumed. He's intrigued. So he approaches the bush and he hears a voice declare, "Do not come any closer. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground." When Moses asks this fire its name, the voice declares, "I am who I am." I am who I am, or simply, I am. Which isn't God being snarky. Instead, this is a statement, I think, about the nature of God, reality itself. God is. God is isness. Is-ness. How's that for God? God is isness. Christian theologians throughout the millennia have referred to this as ultimate reality. Reality is God. Theologians have referred to this as existence itself. Existence is God. They've referred to this as the ground of our being. Theologians have referred to this as life, capital L, life. Life, existence, reality is God. With this in mind, let's now take a moment to ask the question, where is God? Where is isness? Well, throughout the scriptures, we find two primary answers. The first and foremost is this notion of God somewhere else, God in another place, God beyond. We see this God in the Bible creating the world from above, governing the world from afar. And sometimes when God deems it necessary, visiting this world, but always leaving and going somewhere else. And so God is beyond this world. But there's a second answer throughout the scriptures for where God is, which is in and through it all. In and through it all, more than space, time, world of matter and energy, in and through it all, everywhere and permeating everything. We see this God in the Bible as well, which is astounding because in biblical times, most ancient people understood the world, the universe comprised in three stories, heaven, and God is up there in heaven, and then there's earth where we humans abide, and then there's Sheol, the place of the dead. But according to the psalmist in chapter 139, God is in all of those places at the same time. And so perhaps God is everywhere. And in Acts chapter 17, Paul captures the same idea when he explains, "For in God we all live and move and have our being." Thinking logically, one of these ideas about where God is has to be wrong, right? because God cannot be beyond, out there, somewhere else, sometimes visiting, but then always going back, and in and through it all. And yet, biblically speaking, the idea of where God is doesn't fit nicely into our logical thinking. For me, when we move beyond logical thinking into what is called non-dualistic thinking, the Christian mystics begin to be really helpful for me. The mystics have no problem with the idea that God is both beyond and in and through it all. In fact, they even have a word for this, which is panentheism. We've talked before about this at Pearl. Panentheism is not the same thing as pantheism. Pantheism explains everything as God. God is the tree. God is the stream. Whereas panentheism explains everything is in God. Everything is in God, who is both beyond and pervading everything. And although the word panentheism is a fairly recent term to try and name the divinity, only a couple hundred years old, it's a very ancient and deeply Christian notion. Bonhoeffer wrote, "The beyond, capital B, the beyond is in the midst of our life, not on the borders, but at its center." That ancient church father, Irenaeus, wrote, "God contains everything and is contained by nothing." And Moses encountered a burning bush as a voice declared, "I am who I am." Based on these Christian conceptions of what God is and where God is, it's deeply Christian to conclude, isness is everywhere. Isness is in everything, and it is everything's intrinsic relationship to isness that sustains every single thing. And suddenly, these answers to the questions, what is God and where is God, slowly begin to touch on our disappointment in God. And although answers to the questions, why does God allow suffering, and why does God allow pain, and why does God allow bad things to happen, that those answers remain elusive, we are beginning to perceive of how God is in the midst of our suffering and pain and the bad things that happen. God is everywhere. God is in everything. And it is everything's intrinsic relationship to God that sustains every single thing. Now, it's very human to begin asking, well, okay, great, that sounds great, but what does that look like? You know, it's so abstract. These are just abstract theological ideas. Give me a story. Give me a story so I can see that, touch it, perhaps even taste it and ingest it into my very life. In Christian thought, the words that God used to speak creation into existence and the voice that spoke from Moses' burning bush, isness itself. In Christian thought, isness takes on the form of flesh and dwells among us in the life and body of Jesus, who lives and laughs and weeps and eats and sleeps and speaks and suffers and dies. And through the theological land of what we Christians call atonement, we get to see how God is in every darkness, every sorrow, every horror, every injustice, and every death. And this is what we learn. While on the cross, people stood watching, and the rulers sneered at him, and they said, "He saved others. Let him save himself if he is the Christ of God, the chosen one." If he's really God, he could come down from that cross. You see, the people and rulers believed that any real God would take off when the tough gets going, disappear, ascend back into the heavens, leave all of this behind. I think that's how I often perceive of God in my own suffering, you know, like far, far away, or at least indifferent. And yet God in Jesus on a cross doesn't flee. I think this is really important. God in Jesus on a cross doesn't escape. God in Jesus on a cross isn't far away or indifferent. God in Jesus on a cross is very much in the pain. God is in the sorrow. And God is very much in the death. In Christian thought, that's how God is, in it all. On the cross, Jesus cried out, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" God and Jesus on a cross isn't hiding or stuffing or covering his thoughts and feelings and questions. Instead, God and Jesus on a cross is expressing and naming the entirety of his experience. I love this. When I suffer, when I hurt, I think I've learned to not complain, you know? At least not talk about it. I mean, that would be a burden to others. Maybe it would even be ungodly. So I need to keep my composure. And so I think I've learned to just push it down, you know, just push it down. And yet God and Jesus on a cross expresses and names his experience. He names his experience. That's how God is. In Genesis chapter 2, God invited Adam to name the animals. We usually just skip over that, but that's pretty powerful. In speech act theory, it's believed that we create worlds. We create worlds with words. And I think we do. Like, have you ever been in therapy and you're trying to talk out a thing? Like, you're just talking it out and there's the thing, but you can't really name it. You're just kind of talking about it. And your therapist is asking you questions and you're talking about it. And your therapist is saying something. Talk about it from, and then all of a sudden you get some words for the thing, right? Like, you get some words for the thing and suddenly everything shifts. A whole world of understanding is created. It's like a new world is now able to situate our pain and brokenness in more helpful ways because we've been given language to name the thing that is our experience. And God and Jesus on a cross names the pain, names the disappointment, names the brokenness. That's how God is. On the cross, Jesus declared, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." This is really interesting. God and Jesus on a cross isn't cursing. I think putting it this way makes it more explicit. God and Jesus on a cross isn't damning. So many Christians think that God damns. So much so that it's become like a moniker, right? God damn it. I'll always remember Miles saying that to his grandma when he couldn't unbuckle his seat when he was like 5 years old. He certainly got that from his sister. You see, I've been taught, like so many others, that God damns. God damns. And so when bad things happen, I'll often think, this is my fault, or what have I done, or what am I supposed to learn? And yet in this story, God and Jesus on a cross is innocent in his suffering. And so maybe we are too. God and Jesus on a cross is unjustly suffering, and so maybe we in our suffering are too. But the idea that God damn sits so deep in us, and when we're real mad, some of us will scream out, "God damn it." And I think in those moments we wish God would, don't we? We really do. We wish God would damn this moment or that person. And for a moment, our wishful rage blocks out our own pain that's always down deeper, and it always pokes its aching head up once again as the rage fades. And so the words of God in Jesus on a cross invite again and again, forgive. Forgive, don't damn. That's how God is. And that line, "for they do not know what they are doing," I mean, just sit with that for a while. That is a line. "God, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." That's a line. When people hurt me, I often assume the worst about them. I assume the worst about them. But God and Jesus on a cross seems to understand something significant that I in my pain usually miss, which is seeing people. Like, really seeing people. I'm not saying giving them a free pass or saying it's okay or any of those things, but boy, when we were hurt, it's hard to just, like, really see a person. God and Jesus on a cross holds the stories and histories and temperaments and conditions of others that somehow allow God to look at those who harm with a knowing and insight that results in understanding that makes forgiveness possible. It's like when I blow it, God sees me, not just me, but all of me, not just all of me, but all of my ancestors, not just all of my ancestors, but all of the world, not just all of the world, but all of existence, which is to say God sees itself. That's a mind bender, isn't it? And finally, God and Jesus on a cross surrendered, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." God isn't controlling. God in Jesus on a cross isn't grasping. God in Jesus on a cross is surrendering to the fullness of life itself, which we Christians call the way of Jesus. The way of Jesus is so simple that Christians are often tempted to make it into something else, but it stands the test of time. The way of Jesus is life, death, and resurrection. That's the way of Jesus. Life, death, and resurrection. What's the way of Jesus? Life, death, and resurrection. This is the divine path to which God in Jesus on a cross surrenders. For truly, this is how it goes, right? There's no other way. We live, we die, we rise. We live, we die, we rise. We live, we die, we rise. The longer we try to hold off death, any kind of death in any deathly moment is to simply postpone the life that the death is wanting to give birth to in us here and now. Old ways of seeing die and new ways rise. None of us see like we saw 10 years ago. Old ways of being die and new ways rise. Nobody is the same way that they were 10 years ago. Old ways of existing die and new ways rise. If we would just surrender to the death. Perhaps this is why Jesus had such a tough time with religious people and political leaders. They knew so much. They had life in their hands. They didn't need to die. They had it all. They were in control. But God in Jesus on a cross surrenders to itself, which is to say God in Jesus on a cross surrenders to the fullness of life, inviting us to join by offering its own broken body and shed blood for us to hold in our very own hands, to taste in our very own mouths, and to ingest into our very own lives. That's how God is. Why does God allow suffering? I don't know. What is God? Life itself. Where is God? Everywhere and in everything, holding all of this together. How is God? In. Deeply in this, your life. Encouraging you to use all of your ability and words to name it. It's worth that much to be taking time in our lives to name. Inviting you into freedom from bitterness and resentment through understanding and forgiveness and calling. Come, follow after me into life itself. Surrendering again and again to all of the deaths so that new lives might rise until the knowledge of God, love itself, is made eternally manifest. May it be so, and let us pray. God, in our disappointments in life, which is to say in our disappointments in you, help us to see you breaking and bleeding and so generously inviting, come, follow after me into life everlasting.
We hope that this sermon inspired you to ponder the sacred, to consider the mystery and love of God, and to live bountifully. If you don't already support our work, will you begin today? You can donate easily and securely at our website, pearlchurch.org, or follow the link in the podcast notes. Thank you for partnering with us in expressing this sacred story.